most companies don't realize that it needs to be a seat. They know they get to a certain size, that they talk to their peers in different companies, and oh, you need somebody within HR. They don't even really know what that means. They don't know what level of individual they need. They don't know what background of that individual they need. And it differs depending upon the size of your organization. If you're the right person that's coming in with a strategic mindset, the seat is there. You just have to take it.
They keep telling us that it's all over for HR. The age of AI is upon us, and that means HR should be prepared to be decimated. We reject that message. The future of HR won't be handed to us. Instead, it'll be defined by those ready to experiment, adopt, and adapt. Future-proof HR invites these builders to share what they're trying, how it's going, what they've learned, and what's next. We are committed to arming HR with the AI insights to not just survive, but to thrive. Hello and welcome to the Future Proof HR podcast, where we explore how forward-thinking HR leaders are preparing for disruption and redefining what it means to lead people in a changing world. I'm your host, as always, Thomas Kunjapu, CEO of Cleary. And today, I am happy to welcome in Kendall Schultz, the Chief People Officer at Triumph Behavior Support. With 15 years of experience in high-growth environments across venture and private equity portfolio companies, Kendall has led talent and people strategies at organizations like Constellation Software, WeWork, and Capsule. A dynamic operator who blends TA depth with HR strategy, Kendall has built scalable systems and championed psychological safety and delivers measurable results in complex, rapidly changing settings, especially when M&A or IPO readiness or PE value creation is a part of the assignment. So, Kendall, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Let's go way back to the beginning. Tell me about your first job.
I started out in the RPO world. I had no idea what recruiting was. It was in the economic downturn of 2011. So as you can imagine, your parents are really forcing you to get a job with benefits. So I ended up getting connected with somebody who worked at a company out of Boston and got an offer on the spot, came with benefits, and signed. Wasn't really sure what I was diving into, but it definitely was a sink or swim environment. And that's where I got my start in recruiting and led me to where I am today.
So that is definitely a sink or swim environment. What's been some takeaways, if any, that you've kind of kept alongside with you throughout all these years across all these roles?
Yeah, I think some of the main things is really partnership with your hiring managers, obviously. I think that extends all the way into HR as well. The foundation of communication and kind of beating them to the punch. I leverage this even with my team. You could be doing work behind the scenes, but if you're not communicating and vocalizing it, it's as if it's not being done. People are human beings. There's anxieties, right? They have a boss to answer to as well. So you have to be able to provide the data and the backing of proof to what you're actually doing, the work that's being done, regardless of whether or not it leads to success, right? That could be anything from sourcing or outreach and kind of thinking outside of the box, but being able to provide that communication and that insight and tell that story is only going to create a bigger bond, deeper bond with the individuals you're working with. And that, I think, leveraging partnership is where you get a success in hiring in the long run.
Okay, so Kendall, let's talk about something that's often talked about, the seat and the table. When we were doing our prep call, I remember it struck me, you said that HR can't wait to be invited.
Yes.
So how do you create demand and claim that C-suite seat?
I think you have to go in with a mindset of being a fixer and a solutions-oriented individual. It's an iterative department and industry or mechanism within an organization. There's always something to be done. And the reason that you're brought in is because these CEOs and founders or heads of other departments, they know there's things that need to be done and fixed, but you can't rely on them to tell you what it is because that's not their world. So you really have to come in on day one, evaluate what is being done. And I always am a firm believer that we're deep-rooted in product management to a certain extent because there's a roadmap similar to a product roadmap, right? You have to be able to back up and look at it and say, okay, what do we have here? What is the highest risk, number one, for the company? What is the lift? What can we do right away? And let's start chipping away at that list. And essentially, what are the building blocks off of that? What is that going to lead you to? So you have to have a mindset of one at a time kind of tackling. But again, I think it just kind of goes back to my same response to the last question is you have to be the one with communication to bring, here's what's wrong, here's how we're going to fix it. You can't just bring problems, you have to bring the solutions with it. That's where you're going to eventually get a seat at the table. You have to take it. Most companies don't realize that it needs to be a seat. They know they get to a certain size, that they talk to their peers in different companies, and oh, you need somebody within HR. They don't even really know what that means. They don't know what level of individual they need. They don't know what background of that individual they need. And it differs depending upon the size of your organization. Some companies rapid grow really quickly to 50 people, and they've been okay without it, but they're looking to scale within a year's time, 12 months to 500. What you need is not a junior level person. So it's if you're the right person that's coming in with a strategic mindset, the seat is there. You just have to take it.
So what about the other related thing that we're like always like fighting against, which is this view as a cost center, right? It's like a cost sink sometimes. And especially if you take the example that you're talking about where there's an executive team that just, or a CEO that's hired and never had experience with a senior HR person before and just hiring because they're quote supposed to.
Yeah.
Or the board tells them to. In such a world, like how do you take that seat? And also how do you, like, what are the budget realities, right? If you're actually trying to get an agenda executed on, and how do you do that?
I actually love this question because especially in the startup world, I would say it's not just PE, it's also in venture-backed organizations. They do look at it as zero rate on return, right? But that's because they don't understand the value of people. You could have the best product or service in the world. You don't have people, you don't have anything. So yeah, we're often looked at as a support function, but we're also hiring and retaining your individuals. So we technically are the highest generating revenue department for you, because if you have a sales team, who's hiring that sales team? Who's building out their bonus structure? We are. Sometimes payroll, but in my experience, most payroll teams are full of accounting individuals and not actual finance people. So the other thing is when you're growing and scaling as a company, there are so many different products out there to use internally, right? You get ads, you have individuals reaching out to you. It happens to me all the time. I got a couple calls today about products. I get 5 emails a day about coffee chats to try to help me do X, Y, and Z, which I'm already doing. It's when you don't realize that you probably should do your research, and it's like buying a car. You're not going to just go to one dealership. You're going to price compare.
Right.
There's ways to look at an organization. What are their current vendors? Renegotiate contracts. Leverage these vendors against one another. You're going to have cost savings. I did it in Constellation. I put $250,000 back in the budget within a month, right? So when I look at what's the operational cost of my team, I've already paid for myself plus for the entire year within a 30-day time frame. And that's not counting all of the other work and things that we're doing from a risk perspective. You're talking about EEOC claims. You don't have us in place, you're going to get hit with those left and right, because you probably don't know the laws that are changing constantly, the regulations, how to even terminate an employee. When an employee is wronged, when they're terminated, the first thing they're doing is reaching out to a resource or a lawyer and filing a claim. It might go nowhere, but that costs you time and money in and of itself, regardless of where it ends up. You want to hire a lawyer to fight that? They bill by the hour.
Yeah.
So when I think of it from a holistic perspective, if you do it right and your hands are in the weeds, you are directly affecting and impacting how the budget is created and spent within an organization, not only for your department, for the entire ecosystem.
So tell me what that looks like, that ultimate, like really being embedded in the strategy of the organization itself and people's strategy being downstream from that. What does that look like if you're really operating at that level that you're imagining? It's not even a question that you're a part of the C-suite. It's obvious that we're working on the strategy and that you have input. What does that look like? How do you know that you're operating at that level as an HR leader?
You have to take it upon yourself. I don't think that most people in my seat, especially I would say the older generations, it's why I always lean towards calling it the industry is changing to people operations. Right. HR is checking boxes and they're taking emails and complaints and concerns and pretty much just being order takers. If you want to be a true operational function, you have to be able to dig into the strategies of how the company's actually operating. There's a lot of business strategy that comes into play when you're in a seat like mine. And it doesn't come from anyone else in the company. You have to go in and just do it. I ask for forgiveness, not permission, quite frankly. I like to do my homework and bring everything together. I think data points, again, telling the story, doing your due diligence, and then bringing that directly to your decision maker. And what I found is, especially with a very difficult CEO and founder who maybe doesn't like to make decisions or likes to push things off, you have to show them the value and essentially make it so it's their idea, which who cares who gets the credit as long as it gets done, right? That's kind of a win-win for everybody. I think also I always aim high knowing I want to land somewhere in the middle. It's almost like a social engineering approach, I would say, from an advising perspective. And in my experience, it works because you take what you can get, right? And if I can get anything out of, if I come to you with three scenarios and you pick the middle road because you're comfortable with it, I'm okay with that because I can build off of that. And they're going to
see. So you're saying.
So it's going to prove itself.
So if you're coming in with three options, you're thinking through how you can be successful no matter what option ends up happening ahead of that decision.
Interesting. So even if, let's say they pick the least desirable decision that's made, number one, getting a CEO and a founder to make a decision is in and of itself is a win. It's not a no. I don't take no for an answer because even if it is a no, it's a not right now and a maybe, and I can work with that. So if get them to buy in, even if they're skeptical,
right?
I'm so confident in everything that I've done in my experience over the course of my career that I'm willing to bet my position on the decisions that I'm making and presenting. And I haven't failed yet. And I know that, listen, I know that doesn't sound very humble, but I think it's just experience and it's people, right? I work in people. You have to be able to understand how people operate, what makes them tick, how you can make them comfortable in making a decision, in getting that buy-in. I think every person is different, but you have to be the person that really sits and evaluates and takes it all in. And then how do I approach this with this person, essentially, regardless of the position?
It's refreshing and it's a great attitude to have and self-confidence. So speaking of that, you mentioned it. So I'd like to, I made a note because I'm curious. I want to dig in. How does a new HR leader find $100K in direct cost savings, not theoretical, in their first quarter of coming into a role? How does one accomplish that?
There's a number of things, right? So I think there's a lot. You got to look at inefficiencies, number one, and that's time. I like to look at bandwidth. If you go dig into each department, I want to understand the structure. Who's doing what? Who's reporting into who? Who's responsible for what? What systems are they utilizing? If you have people who are sitting around and it's very easy when you're coming in as a new person because people are very laxed, they get set in their ways, they're comfortable, and those people tend to fly under the radar. You have to be able to bring that to the attention of your decision makers and say, hey, we might need to evaluate how this department's operating. And then you start seeing that they start buying in and saying, wow, we have a lot of money waste here. Maybe we have the wrong positions. That in and of itself, you have two people doing the same job and you don't need them. You could be hiring one person that could be doing it and maybe neither of those people. And that's, you never want somebody to be out of a job. They're probably going to get bored and leave anyways. So that costs you money as well. I think the secondary part of it is digging into the vendors that you're, I really believe it, digging into the vendors that you're utilizing. How much are you paying? I've gone into a company and they were paying monthly for a subscription that they've been using for the past 5 years. I looked and I put that together and I evaluated that they wasted $100,000 just because they were paying monthly.
There you go.
So it's in the details. And I think it's just, it's like I said in the beginning, it's evaluating and understanding. You can't go in and just, the mistake people make, I think, is day one, what am I going to change? I've seen it before. My last organization, they hired a CRO. He was very junior, paid him a lot of money, but he didn't stop and evaluate what is currently happening now. He came in super hot and wanted to change everything. It made a complete mess. Nobody respected him. I had to have hour-long conversations with him that took time away from my position. That's money being spent out the window. So I think it's evaluating your current structure, and I think it really is the vendors that you're utilizing.
Got it. And it's the ability to have impact beyond just the budget that's specifically directed at HR, but actually more broadly. Yeah, that's nothing. Headcount. What was that?
HR, in my experience, never gets a budget. We're the first to be let go and the last to be brought on. So they're not going to really give us a budget. They're gonna give us the ability to pitch things that we need, but typically you have to operate very lean. So, you know, you have to create your own budget. And I think that's where my mindset comes from this, because if we don't have one, how can I get one?
And I've talked to a lot of HR leaders where there's teams of one or teams of three, where the ratio, it just continues on for a while, or really what you have are just a recruiting team internally, and there's no one else thinking about anything else, which I think is what you're advocating for around like strategic thinking, right? Around creating an HR team that's able to deliver past the administrative elements or just getting people hired. It's tricky. And so we've been talking a lot about all the different dynamics, almost the internal negotiation dynamics that you need to master to be able to get to these outcomes. So we've been talking about, I don't know, efficiency, redundancies, and like how you need to really be almost like ruthless in getting, finding and executing on budget. But something that struck me when we were preparing was your focus on the flip side on psychological safety, right? And embedding that into your operating model and as a systematically into the organization. So can you tell me a little bit about what that means for you?
I think everything that we do, because it's so people oriented, it's embedded in psychology. You have to understand people. You can't speak to one person one way and another person another way. Everyone's got triggers. But I think if you lead with a psychological approach, you're cultivating an environment where people, one, do feel safe, and they're more willing to open up and actually come to you, which is what we want, right? We want to be a place where people are coming to us because we are the HR team. We're here for people. Companies oftentimes, and this is, again, embedded in HR, HR was typically for the company. People operations is for the best interest of the employee and the company. So we sit on that line. It takes a lot of work to develop psychological safety within an organization. You have to communicate and develop trust. And again, in my last company, I would say I came in and there was none. People were terrified. They thought that if they went to HR, they were on the chopping block. I went to the root core of it. And essentially when my CEO was out of town, pulled the town hall and spoke to everybody. And essentially was like, I have an open door policy. There is no repercussion for you coming forward for anything on your own behalf or somebody else's. And quite frankly, this led to some very big wins. And then if you have one person coming to you, they have a good experience and you provide a resolution or an outcome, you know, they're going to tell their great experience of that to their peers. You're going to start developing a culture that just innately has psychological safety embedded in it.
Ah, so you're talking about the concept of, instead of being the hall monitor, being, you know, having someone who's like open, having a posture that is open for employees to feel like they can actually reveal the core of what's on their mind.
Yeah, I think that, and here's the thing, is they're adults, right? If you treat people like an adult, they will either rise to the occasion or they won't, right? We're not there to reprimand. We're there to reinforce policies and procedures and develop them, obviously. But to your point, like, we are not hall monitors. These are adults. If there's things amongst peer-to-peer that can be resolved between one another, you want to give them the tools to be able to do that. They need to be able to stand on their own. And some people would say you're developing an environment where you're not needed. But I think that they're tied to the culture. They are the culture. So they're going to be the ones that you want to change and shift the culture. They're going to be the ones that are going to give you insight as to what's wrong with the culture as it stands or what's great about it. You're opening the door to have them have a voice. And I think that's extremely important. And ties retention, obviously.
Right. If you feel like you can be open and honest, right? But the nuance there is, I thought it would be more associated with how embedding that feeling towards your peers, your manager, and leadership more broadly, as opposed to the posture specifically with HR. But is that like a step along the way? Is that?
Yeah. I mean, well,
conjecture.
Your peers and your leaders, quite frankly, you manage up, even your CEO. You know what I mean? So, I mean, it's no different with a junior level employee than somebody who's also in a C-suite with me. They're dealing with their own things. It just might be in a different level of, okay, they're managing people and their problems might be a little bit different. But I think holistically, it's all tied to the same fundamental approach.
But I guess I wonder, what are the limits of the leverage as an HR function in creating this concept of like psychological safety within the context of an employee's relationship with their manager and with their peers and with the C-suite, as opposed to their relationship with HR? So I think in the example, you're talking about how it's important to ensure that folks can feel like they can come to people operations, let's call it, and there's psychological safety there. But how do you take that and translate that into the day-to-day life? People aren't talking to HR all day. They're working with each other. So how do you translate that into just the reformation or evolution of the culture, which is lived, well, you know, without you in the room?
That's the thing, though. If they've never had that, you have to be in the room because they don't have the tools or the skills, right? So if you're bringing somebody who's reporting into a manager and a manager into a room, you have to be there to help almost mediate and get them to a point where they can then take those skills and repeat them on their own or build off of them. And then it kind of seminates across the organization, right? But you can't do it on a piece of paper. You can't do it in a policy. You can't do it through an email or Slack. You have to be involved. In my experience, if you're not, you're only sweeping things under the rug because you're leaving them to their own devices. And not everybody's equipped to understand the psychological safety approach or even what that means. I can tell a manager, hey, you should do this, this, try this, this, and this. Okay, they might go and do it, but maybe their direct report has a problem with their tone and their tone was still that way in that meeting. You see what I'm saying? So,
right.
So you have to get to the root problem and provide awareness on both sides so that they can come together and move forward.
Yeah, it sounds like you're really advocating for setting examples and being consistent in setting examples throughout the organization. And then that can slowly start to snowball into shifting the culture forward, especially in environments where you have folks without a lot of experience in either management or people dynamics or a real focus on it, right?
Yeah.
And
it happens a lot.
Speaking of that,
world.
It happens a lot in startup world. Yeah, it's probably the
system. There's a lot of let's promote this person because we don't want to lose them, but they have no experience in managing. There's no training oftentimes. So I've had to advocate for LMS systems, which legally you're supposed to have as well. So you reinforce it with certain tools on your side. But I really do think it's human to human and it's providing that support and guidance.
So this is all happening in the context of, I would say, whipsaw environments, potentially, right? Hyper growth,
yes.
Riffs. Rehiring, okay. HR teams themselves being the first ones to be let go and then brought back when the times are good. There's a lot of whipsawing happening, right? And you've been in so many environments like that. Do you have a playbook in this context that helps protect culture and momentum when there's so much whipsaw?
I think it's a fundamental characteristic of by nature, essentially. I wouldn't say it's a playbook that I follow. I think it's just a moral compass, essentially, based on any environment I'm going into. But I do think I've often been told that I advocate to the fullest, right? So I make sure that I speak up. I continue to hammer the problem home until people understand and see that there needs to be change or something needs to be addressed. I'll tell you, there was an incident, for example. There really was no culture. It was a very negative culture. It was fear culture, I would say, in an organization I worked in. This employee came to me because she had been promoted to a marketing team. She was going to have to work with the chief of the design and marketing department. Come to find out, this was her first job. She had been there for 2 years. She started during COVID. They had an outing, apparently, and this was prior to my start, where he made some suggestive, inappropriate comments, and it was continual throughout the entire event that they were kind of team bonding. She reported it and nothing was done. Now, fast forward to her promotion, she now has to sit in a room and work with this individual. She's very uncomfortable. the fact that she even stayed is insane, because there's also she can sue or do something about it. There's a 3-year statute of limitations and she's still working there. So it hasn't even started yet. The second I found out about this, I got up out of my seat, which if you're in person, I think I ran around my office because you have to have a presence. I went directly into my CEO and founder's office and pretty much laid it on the line. And from a moral perspective, essentially said, if he's not let go, I will quit. And he was terminated the next day. And he had been working there for 7 years.
This has been a fantastic conversation so far. If you haven't already done so, make sure to join our community. We're building a network of the most forward-thinking HR and people operations professionals who are defining the future. I will personally be sharing news and ideas around how we can all thrive in the age of AI. You can find it at gocleary.com/cleary-community. Now back to the show. Oh, wow. Okay.
So
that takes a clear moral compass. So this is, you're mentioning in this case where, I mean, there's something like proactive, arguably it's in peacetime, right? But it's an example of that.
Yeah.
I think what is really tough for so many employees is like in these times of whipsaw where they're, you know, like there's a certain way that we're working, but then the reality is all of a sudden there's a rift, right? And like there's like this potential like breach of trust systematically, which is really hard to regain. I think many of our listeners have been through that on different sides of that. And no one has empathy, let's call it, for HR leaders as they're like executing through that. But this is a really tough example. But then on top of that, when it's happening systematically in the organization, how does that ethical and moral compass, how does that guide you in these situations?
I think I've been through a lot. I've had to lead and charge a lot of risks in layoffs and in restructurings, essentially. And you could use either term interchangeably, obviously.
Yeah.
But I think the most important part is you need to do right by the individuals that you're letting go. So it's dependent upon, let's say you also have, there's also situations from a state perspective. If you let go of a certain percentage, you are required by law to give garden leave. Now, if not, and let's say it's just under the gun and you can do what you want. And I don't say me doing what I want, but the CEO and founder who's making essentially this choice and decision and then handing it over for us to execute.
Right.
I'd like to sit down and essentially say, let's build out a model here. Okay. So how long have let's structure in tiers. This person's been here a year. What is fair? I know that realistically, they're probably not going to have a job for 30 days. And then in this economy, it's probably even worse, right? So if they've been with us for 2 years, let's give them 2 months, things of that nature. And there's some negotiating in there as well. I present a plan essentially before anything's even executed to ensure that we're doing right by the people that we're letting go. That's number one. Secondarily, you need to get in front of the employee population and you need to calm their nerves. I think it needs to come from the top. I think it needs to come from your HR leader. And I also think it needs to be reinforced by your department leaders and managers, right? So you also have to give them the tools for people who are going to come to them so that they alleviate some of that, what is, am I next? That nervous energy and anxiety that comes along with seeing your peer no longer sitting next to you. It's transparency and it's open communication. And you're going to have people who it's going to impact their performance, right? So it takes a little bit more of handholding with those leaders to ensure that people aren't falling behind. That is an empathetic approach. And there's, again, a lot of psychology behind that. People are not just coming in and operating. They do have a personal life. They do have feelings. They do have things that are impacting their day-to-day that are outside of those walls of that office. So I think just being mindful of it and being a human being about it, although it is difficult and it's a business decision and it has to be done, I also like to be a resource for people that be let go. I will be a reference. I will help network with you to, you know, if I hear of a job, I will connect you. I will push you forward to agencies and things that I know exist that I have contacts to help you find another job. I don't know that everybody does that, but I do.
Thank you for going through some of these examples of how you might tactically deal with something that so many of us have been a part of in the last few years, right? With the whipsaw of the COVID boom and end of zero interest rate, end of ZERP and all the rest, right?
Here's the ups and downs.
Right. We've all lived it. But through that, I think one of the things I definitely wanted to talk to you about was the concept of HR operations as a product. So you've been talking about that And I'm very curious because my own background is in product management. So tell me about how you think about the service or the product that you offer and how that metaphor is useful for you.
Yeah, I think I like to think of HR as an iceberg, right? People only see the tip. There's so much that goes into operating an organization, building out an organization, which by association, we are doing. You have to look forward and align with the company goals. And if a company doesn't have goals, you have to push them to understand what they are. Bring the right people into the room. What is everybody working on? Where are we working towards? What is it going to take to get there? Because with that information, I can then evaluate, okay, what do we need to do and what do we need to prepare for? So a company changes at 100 people. It changes again at 200, changes again at 500, and again at 1,000. The way you operate and the things you have in place today are not necessarily going to work tomorrow. So you have to anticipate, just like a product, where do we need to innovate and improve? And when do we need to do it? I push my team, and I get pushback sometimes until they understand where I'm coming from. To do the extra work now, it might not be needed right now, but it sure is going to be helpful and useful for us to build off of what we're going to need to do next. So if you do the work on that now and you had some of that prep, it goes a lot faster. You can get business decisions a lot faster, build business cases a lot faster. You're not sitting and digging for the data. I'll use Greenhouse for an example. Right now, we want to get to a point where we can proactively understand how many people we need to hire. We're moving into North Carolina. I put Greenhouse in place because they have the best data in the market if you set up your product properly. I leverage that to show tracking and trends of what is our activity, where are our bottlenecks, where are our gaps. That's going to lead you into, okay, what is our objective and our plan? How many people is it going to take? We can actually build out a timeline, essentially, of not only how many people do I need on my team now to be able to fill the needs of this business in a specific amount of time, but we can also agree to a certain number of hires based on the productivity that we've had in the past. So just like a product, you know, you're looking back at how it's evolved in how it's been adopted, where there are the gaps in how you can tackle and improve those. We are a product team to a certain extent. Our product's just people. It really is.
Every product team then is being impacted and is thinking about how AI will come into the adoption loop or into the processes and the systems that they've put in place. How do you think about that within this, especially within this concept of HR ops as a product?
It's funny because when I left my last job, AI really took off in a way that had never really impacted my industry ever. We really operate, not much has changed really, other than the fundamentals and how we approach things. But the tools that we've had have consistently been the same. We've been a department or industry that not many people have paid attention to, and from a toolage perspective. I would say about June of last year, July, August is really when, okay, hey, AI can hire for you, so you don't need humans anymore. Well, these products are brand new, and you're putting them with people that can, sure, can implement a system, but have never implemented something like this before. It's an enablement tool, which means you still need human beings to be able to operate it. Now, if you ask anybody, the market was a mess because you have a number of people applying with a system that's new that hasn't really had a chance to operate and collect the proper data, knocking out almost everybody before it even hits a real person. So you have jobs that are not getting filled. That's churning and burning cash. You have people getting burnt out and leaving positions because of it. And now, okay, wait, maybe we need one recruiter, and they're sourcing the same people. So talk about a money waste. Now, do I think AI is good? 100%. I think we can leverage it in a number of ways. I think about like sourcing automation. People are out there. If we can put in keywords and locate individuals, I'm all for that, and put them into a pool, into the ATS, you know, scrape and source and do all of that. That takes time away from my people that they have to go on LinkedIn and search and Boolean string, right? We've been working off Boolean strings for decades.
Yeah.
So I think it's something that's going to be important, and I think it's going to change our industry a good bit. But I think the businesses need to understand the impact of it. And I think that the companies that are selling it need to understand what they're actually pitching, because it can be detrimental. And we've seen that over the past 10, 12 months.
Yeah, I've heard this narrative, not narrative, but just like this perspective from a lot of operators that the AI vendors are just beating us over the head with AI this and that, and everything's going to change. And effectively, it's a landscape where there's a lot of overpromising happening, which I think is what you're saying. But then you did mention, though, that there's some future where there can be maybe some of that can happen. But at least for now, you need to be, there are elements. So you specifically called out sourcing as an element where you actually see value. So have there been actually any integrations or implementations that you can speak to already that right now you feel are already starting to make improvements and add efficiencies to your team and workflows?
Yeah. So again, I could be a promoter of Greenhouse. They are tried and true, and they actually acquired a company, I'm at a loss for the name of it right now, but they actually already had sourcing automation built into their system. So it was an offering that they did their due diligence on, purchased the organization, and built it right into their system. It's phenomenal because it can scrape LinkedIn and can do certain things. But I do think that there's still room for improvement, obviously. I think there's a lot of room where AI can come into play. I would love to see it tackle like career fairs and events. My team's at a career fair right now in New York City. Maybe we can do something with AI that allows us to attract candidates as opposed to the traditional marketing aspects. I'd love to be able to do that through a platform, because it is very manual right now. So that marketing landscape hasn't changed a whole lot. But there's, you know, there is a way to do it. I mean, I'm not an AI expert by any means. It's really not my forte. But as an end user, I mean, look, I like ChatGPT. I'll write my emails, plop it in, and make sure that it comes out right. So it is a useful tool if it's in the right hands.
So let's talk about those hands and how they may need to evolve over time. So if you had to look ahead a little bit for the HR function itself, and maybe there's some overpromising with here's AI recruiters, but across all the different use cases and types of programs that we run in the function, there's potential for at least parts of it for AI to take over. So then if you step back and think about your team or teams like yours, or in PE or VC backed environments that are, you know, growth focused and need to be focused on being lean, what do you think is going to be demanded more of from the HR and people operations function? And are there things that are going to be demanded less of in the future?
That's a tough question, quite frankly, because I still believe that most organizations still don't understand HR or people operations, whichever you want to call it at this point. They demand whatever you're willing to give them. I've been in seats where I was hungry and I tackled everything. And the next thing you know, I'm doing payroll systems and I'm handling green cards. I'm opening entities in Dubai. I'm handling office management. So, you know, I've had to take a step back after that to essentially say, okay, you know, this is what we do and what we don't do. There's a lot of education that is needed, I think, around what HR's functionality is and what we offer and what we're supposed to be doing, because we're looked at as a support function. And it's, if this team can't do it, we'll give it to the HR. They'll figure it out. So I really don't think less is going to be demanded of us. I think it's more of education around and boundaries in terms of holding other departments and teams accountable to not hand off work, because I think that happens quite frequently. They pass the buck, especially in PE backed companies, because you're walking into an organization where there's never been somebody who's actually had recruiting experience. So they're hiring on a whim. I like this person. They're great. So you have, again, I had a whole team that I was working with that was all in accounting. They had zero finance experience. There was not a finance team. So we had to hire the right people. I think it starts with hiring the right people for your HR team and putting that as a focus, because it ties in everything we've talked about. Culture, retention. And I know we veered off a little bit AI, but like, I think it has nothing to do with AI. I think it really, we're not there yet. I think people just need
to. Let's talk about that. What skills matter most for HR over the next couple of years? Is there anything that's becoming even more central and important to the role? If I'm reflecting what you're just saying, it's just like the ability to be an ambassador and like selling the role itself and like talking about what to expect and not expect confidently. But yeah, tell me what you think is going to really matter in terms of skill sets.
Well, I think more individuals within my space need to develop that approach because we need to band together to start changing the landscape within these organizations. It's very individualized. I mean, I can step into a role in a company and I'm working one way. My peer can step into a role in a different company and he or she's working another way. So I think we need to set a precedent, and I think we need to have a voice, and we need to be able to show that we are an industry in a vital department that is needed in companies. And I think that message needs to be spread across the landscape of PEs and VC-backed growing organizations. It hasn't changed yet. We have a lot of work to do just ourselves, I think. And it comes from us in networking and getting together and knowledge sharing. I tap into my network and I want to know how somebody's handling this. I want to understand what trials and tribulations they're dealing with and how they've tackled it. I think that's really where it starts. It starts with us, and it starts with developing a message and again, having a seat at the table holistically. I think the C-suite, we're part of the C-suite, but does everybody recognize that within an organization? No, not always. So we're at the baseline, I think, of the work is there. The skills are there. It's recognizing the vital of our department, our role.
I'm almost translating that in my mind as like negotiation skills. Like you're basically negotiating the rationale behind your role and what you're doing day to day in your department and resetting in many cases what that actually is for the C-suite that you're collaborating with. Because even if they're hiring a co-C-suite member, they might not have the experience of working with someone at that level with the new way of working where you actually can be strategic and be a leverage point for the organization. And often many people are hiring because like you said, they're supposed to, they're told that they're supposed to. And then the real outcomes that they're focused on is, okay, I guess they can run the compliance things that we need. And then they can go and try to help us hire a bunch of people. But then putting those pieces together is not necessarily something people are naturally thinking about or asking for, but that's the gap that you need to kind of discover on your own if that exists and then go ahead and jump into that, right?
Yeah, I think there's a combination, and it just a light bulb went off my head a little bit with when they're told that they need to hire somebody. Again, as I mentioned, it's okay, can I get a person at this level, like 3 years of experience making $80,000? They don't understand what they even need, which is, again, they're calling them head of people or they're calling them chief people officers, but they're 3 years out of school. And they're like, why aren't they can't do this? There needs to be education within our space that there are people out there at a senior level that have years of experience that have been through the trials and tribulations and can share the successes of why you need to hire and invest in somebody more senior, because you're just putting a Band-Aid on a bullet wound to a certain extent with hiring somebody who's junior and expecting them to do everything that this role entails. So again, I think it's education and helping them understand what the job description is.
Yeah. So then as we close out here, Kendall, if you're talking directly to your peers, other HR leaders, and for what really matters for the function as we're trying to future-proof HR and people operations, is there a message that you have or something that comes to mind that you would share with your peers?
Yeah, I think we all face, no's, and we're fighting uphill battle every day. But I think the more that we push back and show the worth of and value of what we do, that's going to change the landscape and the mindsets of leaders, CEOs and founders, regardless of what industry they're in, regardless of what space they're in. We need to start stepping up in a way that we're not looking at protecting our job security. I think that's what I lead with. I mean, quite frankly, I put myself on the chopping block to ensure that things are done right. We can't be afraid that we're going to lose our job. We have to create the space, and you won't lose your job if we're all doing things that we should be doing and advocating employees that we're supposed to be serving.
I think that's a great place as any to leave the conversation, Kendall. Let's extol everyone out there to have the courage to do what you probably know is right and just lean in there and make the case for what you want for the organization as well as your function. And we can move beyond a fear-based thinking, which I think is prevalent actually at this particular moment with a confluence of factors with the economy, with the hiring cycle that we're generally in with the labor market, as well as AI coming in. But thank you. So I think it's a very timely conversation. As many folks out there who are listening are looking to future-proof their organizations as well as their HR functions, and this is a bit of a roadmap, I think, some ideas there about how you can stay relevant. And it'll really stay with me, the concept of educating your C-suite, right? Educating your peers within your function about what you can and cannot do, but leaning into as many things as possible. And thank you for all these examples of the level of specificity at which you need to be actually engaged to actually get that seat at the table. So with all that said, thank you again to Kendall. And for everyone out there, good luck as you're on your own journeys to future-proof your organizations and the function overall. I'll see you on the next one. Bye now. Thanks for joining us on this episode of Future Proof HR. If you like the discussion, make sure you leave us a 5-star review on the platform you're listening to or watching us on, or share this with a friend or colleague who may find value in the message. See you next time as we keep our pulse on how we can all thrive in the age of AI. Hey, it's Thomas again. One quick question before you go. Are you and your HR team tired of answering the same employee questions again and again in Slack? If yes, our Cleary AI-powered Slackbot is here to help. It takes routine employee requests and answers it automatically while freeing up time for you to take on more important tasks. At the same time, it automatically builds up an HR knowledge base as you go. It's quick to set up, works right in Slack, and you can try it for free. Just head on over to gocleary.com/HR-chatbot to install it. It's again, gocleary.com/HR-chatbot. Thanks again.